please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Veryl Dana LLP. I'm Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Chris Lockman, also from Veryl Dana. He focuses his practice on employee benefits and executive compensation. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So first, Chris, one of the things that I always like to do when we start any program is for our listeners to learn a little bit more about our guests so that they can understand why it's important to listen to this person and why they have important information to share. So can you tell us a little bit about your path to becoming an employee benefits and executive compensation attorney?
Sure, absolutely. I actually had sort of an indirect path to this area of practice. I went to law school and started my career in the bankruptcy world. And after moving back to Maine, I started doing more and more work in the benefits area because it was right after the Affordable Care Act was passed. And so employers had a lot of questions. We were getting more and more business in that area. And I've decided a few years ago to dedicate my practice full time to benefits work.
Are there similarities between the bankruptcy area practice and employee benefits and comp?
There's one major similarity, and that's the fact that they're both federal statutory based. So anywhere you go in the country, the rules are the same for bankruptcy, just like they are for ERISA, with minor differences.
So if you are a small employer in Tennessee or Arkansas, the things that we're talking about today, kind of generally with regards to federal ERISA and 401ks and IRAs, that's applicable. It doesn't matter where you live, correct?
Absolutely. The Internal Revenue Code is nationwide, and so is ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which has to do with all of your fiduciary duties as an employer sponsoring a plan for your employees.
Perfect. So we're kind of getting into it slowly but surely, but let me ask you directly, because we know how good lawyers are at being direct. We never say, oh, there's some gray area or maybe. I mean, how often does maybe come out of my mouth every week? But what exactly does an employee benefits and executive compensation lawyer do?
Well, we do three types of things. The first type is we help employers who sponsor retirement plans for their employees comply with the law and also defend them against audits from the Department of Labor and the Internal Revenue Service or claims from their employees or past employees. The second thing that we do is advise them about their welfare benefit plans, which are really health insurance and then any other type of benefit that you offer your employees that's not retirement. The third area, executive comp, is really compensation for your C-suite folks, your owners, and so on. We advise employers about how to structure those plans and meet their needs.
Now, specifically with regards to, let's focus just on benefit, retirement benefit plans. Mm-hmm. Why would somebody come to you as opposed to going to an accountant or a bookkeeper or a financial planner generally? Because I think when we think about retirement or those type of issues, immediately we think of some type of financial planner. What is the necessity of going to a lawyer?
Sure. First off, many people will start with their accountant or a broker. Or advisor or benefits consultant. And that makes a lot of sense. They can help you with some of those upfront design issues. What are you trying to accomplish and what objectives do you have? What are your employees' needs? But oftentimes it's a good idea to run whatever they discuss with you by a lawyer. And the reason for that is the broker that you're dealing with, the consultant or the accountant, each represent their own interests in their own firm. When you talk to a benefits lawyer, they're representing you. And so regardless of what product your investment advisor offers you or your accountant thinks might be a good fit, we can help you and our license is on the line to ensure that you're making the best decision for you and for your employees. And if you're a fiduciary, for the plan. In addition, sometimes there are litigation, audits, and investigations, and the idea of going it alone is often a bad one.
So based off of kind of how you've just described it, do you work with closely with other professionals then? Do you work closely with investment advisors and accountants, or do you primarily deal with CFOs and COOs and CEOs, or is it a mix?
It's a combination. So our client is the plan sponsor, so the employer, in their capacity as the sponsor of the plan, which is a separate legal entity. But we work cooperatively. Usually it's the C-suite people, the CEO, CFO, president, that are making decisions about the plans. And we work cooperatively with their accountants, sometimes actuaries if they have a very complicated plan, their brokers and advisors.
Now, if you're an HR professional at a larger organization, you likely have a team of people who are devoted to focusing on employee benefits issues. But for smaller employers, when we start talking about SEP IRAs or simple IRAs, I know that my clients, their heads start spinning. I would love for our goal today, with hope, be to provide smaller employers with a little bit of clarity as to some of the more vexing questions concerning benefits issues generally, and maybe when they should be contacting an employee benefits or executive compensation attorney generally.
Sure. The first reason is really the reason I want to avoid, but it's if you get contacted by the Internal Revenue Service or Department of Labor, you may be tempted to try to go it alone, or you may, your first call might be to an accountant. Before you respond, talk to one of us, because we deal with these folks every day. We deal with a lot of plans, and we can help talk you through any issues that come up. Usually it's just a bill from the Internal Revenue Service, and you don't really know why you got it. That's one way. The other way is we can help you talk through some of the issues if you're trying to set up a plan for the first time and you're not really sure where to start. We have connections with other accountants and advisors and investment advisors. We can talk to you first about what your responsibilities are as the employer and then point you in the right direction to get started.
So I think the great part about all of this is that we all know that I'm not a benefits attorney. So many of these words and phrases are new to me. So I thought that the first thing we could do is let's talk about retirement benefits, because I think that's on a lot of people's minds. It's at the forefront of most employees' kind of thought processes. What type of retirement benefits do I have? What is the employer going to provide? So let's talk about that first and then jump into welfare.
Okay.
So first, I know what an IRA is, but what's the difference between a SEP IRA and a simple IRA?
Okay. So an IRA is a custodial account. It's owned by your employee individually. It's not a plan where all of your assets and contributions are going into one big pot sponsored by the employer. But SEPs and simples are employer plans to help employees contribute to their own IRA accounts. The major difference between a SEP IRA and a simple IRA, there are a couple, but I'll walk through the basic ones, is that a SEP IRA is extremely simple. It can be established by filling out one form, putting it in a file. You don't have to file anything with the IRS, and you don't have to do annual filings with the IRS. But only employer money can be contributed to a SEP IRA. So if your employees want to be able to defer some of their own salary or their hourly wages to an account, you can't do that through a SEP IRA. It's just an annual contribution by the employer or done on a payroll basis of a percentage of your employees' income.
So it wouldn't be something where there would be an employee match, correct? So with a SEP IRA, only the employer or the company is putting money into this retirement account.
That's exactly right. The other thing that you should keep in mind about a SEP is that all of your employees, with the exception of a few excluded categories, will be entitled to receive a contribution of the same percentage of their compensation. So you can't give Sally 30% of her income actually there's a cap at 25. You can't give her 13% of her income in a contribution and give Joe 5% of his income. You can deviate a little bit between employees, but the numbers are very, very small.
Now, is it only based off of a percentage of income, or could it be a flat fee, such as I'll put $5,000 into a SEP IRA for each of my employees without regard to their job title or duties?
So it should be a percentage of their income, really, because that makes sure that everybody gets equal footing in terms of percentage of comp.
So that's a SEP IRA. Let's talk more broadly about the simple IRA.
Sure. Real quickly, the difference between a simple IRA and a SEP is that the simple will allow employees to defer money to their own retirement account. So regardless of what the employer will match or contribute, the employee has the ability to adjust their own savings rate for the retirement plan. Specifically, and there are annual limits that change every year, they're allowed in 2019 to put up to $13,000 of their income, their own income, every year into the SEP IRA, simple IRA plan. And the employer must contribute either 2% of their comp or match at 100% up to 3% of their comp that's put toward the plan. So the employer has a choice about whether to make a contribution for everybody, regardless of whether they save their own money, or match everybody who decides to participate. But the big thing is it allows employees to decide their own savings rate. Well, as a SEP, the employees have no discretion and can't put in any of their own money.
Now, what's the difference between an IRA and a 401k?
Sure. So an IRA is a custodial account. Like I said, it's owned by the individual employees, and they can take it with them, basically, if they switch jobs or decide to save on their own if they become self-employed at some point. A 401k, they can often roll those accounts over to other retirement plans if they switch jobs, but that's more controlled by the employer. And 401ks come in a couple different varieties. But the ones that are most relevant for small employers are simple 401ks and then just your full form 401k. And there's a new twist that I'll talk about.
So if we are a small employer, let's say we have 80 employees, right? Mm-hmm. Is there something that is probably easier for us to do, whether it's a SEP, IRA, or a simple IRA? Would one of those make more sense just from a logistical standpoint normally?
Sure. It depends on what you're willing to do in terms of paying attention to the plan and what your employees really want. If your employees just want their employer to help them save for retirement, the SEP IRA might be sufficient. If the employees are looking for the ability to defer their own income, to control their own savings rate, then a simple IRA might be right for you.
I'm Tani Alvarez, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
It's 3 p.m., and you just ran out of ink. You have a report due end of day, which is 2 hours from now. You can't push the deadline because end of day means end of today, not end of tomorrow day. What now? Go to your local Staples store. Staples now has an even bigger selection of HP ink and toner, in store, in stock, and at low prices every day. So you can get your ink fast for less. End of story.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
Hi, this is Derek Volk, host of The Derek Volk Show. I want to tell you about my book, Chasing the Rabbit, A Dad's Life Raising a Son on the Spectrum. My book is a rare and emotionally truthful story of my experiences as a father raising a son on the autism spectrum. When Dylan was 2 years old, my wife sat me down and said, "Something's not quite right with Dylan." My book takes you from birth to that day at age two until he was diagnosed with autism 6 years later, and then through his extremely rocky middle school years, his volatile high school life, and his challenging path to adulthood. The story has been called extremely raw and shockingly honest, and has been given 5 stars by every review on Amazon. Please go to our website, chasingtherabbit.org, to learn more about our story. That's chasingtherabbit.org.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and our guest today is attorney Chris Lockman. We're talking about employee benefit issues faced by smaller employers. We spent the first part of the program talking a lot about SEP IRAs, simple IRAs, and we had just started talking about 401ks and simple 401ks. Chris, let's jump back and talk a little bit more about 401ks and why that might make sense for a smaller employer.
Sure. There are two types of 401ks that are options for small employers. The first one is a simple 401k, and just like the simple IRA, you can only have 100 employees if you want to sponsor a simple 401k. So they're made for the true small employer.
So if I currently have 90 employees and I know by next year I'll have 105, I shouldn't be setting up a simple 401k at this point in time, correct?
That's exactly right, because you can't sponsor an additional plan while you're sponsoring a simple 401k. So you'll have to go through a pretty painful transition process a year from after you establish the plan.
So understanding, I think, that cap is really important for our listeners, because if your growth model is such that within the next 3 to 5 years you foresee having over 100 employees, it seems like it doesn't make a ton of sense to start out with a simple 401k when you're simply going to that wasn't a joke, people. Kind of was. That you're going to then have to have a 401k.
That's right. And the other thing is the simple 401k is really designed for the small employer who doesn't want a lot of design flexibility. Just like the simple IRA, you have a choice. You can either make a flat 2% contribution to your employees, or you can match up to 3% of their income. And the employees' deferrals are capped at $13,000. With a 401k plan, a full-blown 401k plan, you have a lot of flexibility regarding how to design your plan, who's eligible, when and how much you're going to match, so on and so forth. So it offers someone who's growing a lot more flexibility than a simple 401k model.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but other than IRAs and 401ks, there are other types of retirement plans that are available to employers as benefits to employees. But is that outside the scope of today?
Yes, it is. And the reason why is because 401ks are actually a subset of what are called 401A plans, which profit sharing. There's a whole bunch of different things you can do in that area. There's also defined benefit plans, the old traditional pension that guaranteed you a certain number of dollars every month in retirement. Those have gone by the wayside and really been replaced by 401ks.
So now that we have an understanding of baseline type of retirement accounts that are most generally used, give me an idea of some of the biggest challenges that small employers face in this area, or what you see most often being difficult for small employers to accomplish from a retirement benefit standpoint.
Yes, unfortunately, this is when I often get the first call. And it's always better to know these things up front, but usually I don't get a call until there's a problem.
And so it's not help us create the program, it's help us fix an issue with the program.
Exactly. And so the number one issue, particularly for small employers, is the set it and forget it problem, which is when I get a call from usually the one person who does all the HR stuff at the employer. And usually she has heard about us from her accountant and calls us and says, I got this letter from the IRS that says I have a penalty for failing to file or doing something that I was supposed to do. Every single one of these plans, regardless of how simple, has a series of responsibilities that the employer in its capacity as plan sponsor needs to do. Notices, tax reporting, tax withholding, filings. Once you establish a plan, it may just be a matter of giving your employees an annual notice or filing an annual return with the IRS. And your payroll company or record keeper will help you do that. But if you're not paying attention to it, years can go by, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I should have been doing this since the day we established our plan. I've never done it, and now I have a problem. And the penalties can be severe.
So when we're talking about the creation of any form of a retirement plan, in some areas of corporate operation, paperwork is important, but it's not as important as the organization may make it out to be. In this situation, deadlines and filings and notices, how important are they, let's say just from a financial standpoint? Are we talking about $200 fines, $2,000 fines, $20,000 fines, or my favorite lawyer answer, it depends?
Yeah. It depends. But for example, your failure to file fines for the Department of Labor, if you were to have a 401k plan, start around $2,000 a day for each day you're late.
Is there a cap on how many days late you potentially can be? Like, do we get to $10,000 and they stop, or no?
That depends as well. oftentimes, the caps are in the millions of dollars.
So two lawyers sit down and have a conversation and pretty much just say it depends to each other for an hour.
That's right. Well, for small employers, we can take a specific example. So the Department of Labor, if you have a plan that's a simple 401k plan or 401k plan, you're required to file a tax return for that plan every year. The plan is a separate legal entity.
So in addition to your normal corporate filings with the IRS, your 401k is also going to have its own tax return?
Exactly. It's pretty simple, and it's called a Form 5500. It's pretty simple for small employers. For large employers, they'll have to get a full-scale audit that goes along with it. But basically, it just reports the financial transactions in and out of the plan for the year. And if you're a small employer, the DOL has a current DOL enforcement program that allows you some relief for penalties. But you're still looking at $300 a day for every day you're late in filing that form. And that can pile up significantly, up to $30,000.
So this is Tawny Alvarez, and we're talking to Chris Lockman from Vero Dana today, and we're talking about employee benefit and executive compensation issues that small businesses face. I just asked, and we were just discussing one of the biggest issues that small employers face when dealing with retirement benefit plans, and that was a set it and forget it. Are there other issues that you see regularly with regards to retirement plans that small employers face?
Yeah, the two other areas, and they're linked, are failure to follow the terms of the plan. So, for instance, your plan says, I'm going to make a match at 3%. So everybody defers, and everybody who defers will get up to 3% of a match from the employer. And you forget to do it, or you do it at 2%, or you do it late.
What if you don't have the money to do it? What happens if you say you're going to do 3%, but that's just not in the budget? You either have to make payroll or not make payroll and make that contribution.
The answer to that is the IRS doesn't care. You've made a promise, and there are certain plans that will allow you to apply for an exception to have that penalty, that promised match reduced for simple IRAs, for instance. But for the most part, if you promise to make a match, you have to make it, and you have to make it timely. And if you fail to do that, the consequences from the perspective of the IRS are that your plan is disqualified. What that means is all of the money that the employer has put in on your employee's behalf and all the money your employees have deferred to the plan will become immediately taxable to your employees and cannot be rolled over to a new employer. So the consequences are pretty devastating. The IRS isn't in the business of disqualifying plans, and so they've established a correction program to allow employers the ability to fix these problems if there's been an oversight. The important thing to remember is the longer that you wait, if you've made a match incorrectly or if you've calculated the employer contribution incorrectly, the longer you wait, the more expensive it gets to fix.
So this isn't something that we should push off till later because it's time consuming and confusing and our CFO has gone on vacation, because on a daily basis we're incurring additional fees, correct?
That's absolutely right. If you've made a contribution that's not high enough, or if you have failed to deposit your employees' deferrals to the plan on time, talk about that a little bit more in a minute, then they are entitled, or the plan is entitled, to earnings on those amounts every day that goes by. Plus, interest will accrue every day that goes by. Plus, if you pass a certain period, additional penalties for failure to report that problem may also accrue.
So for smaller employers, one of the things that I've heard about more recently and that I've received questions about is regarding multiple employer plans. So I think they're 401k plans, but can you talk a little bit about what those are and whether or not there is a benefit to smaller employers as to that?
Sure, and there's a huge benefit to smaller employers. So we'll take a step back and we'll talk about the full-blown 401k plan here. One of the downsides of a full-blown 401k plan, even though it's flexible, is that it can be expensive. You have to get typically an investment advisor. You have to get someone to record keep the plan, so keep track of everyone's contributions, the money coming in and going out. And there's just a lot of overhead and management that goes into it. It's very difficult for a small employer to have a committee and talk about the plan. What multiple employer plans allow small employers to do is team up based on their industry or based on their geographic region, whether it's a major metropolitan area or employers within a single state, and all participate in the same plan. And there are some different rules about these. The rules were actually just very recently finalized. So we haven't seen these plans yet. In fact, their first time they can be effective is really later in 2019. But they could be a powerful tool for small employers, because what you're doing is spreading the administrative cost of operating a plan across several employers that all have a like mind. So for instance, a trade association or a regional commerce council.
So that would then take some of that administrative burden off of an individualized small employer. Is that correct?
Exactly. And you get better pricing. So a lot of the funds that are available to invest in, mutual funds, the price that you get and the fees that you pay to invest in those funds, the more money that are invested, the lower, the better price, the better deal you get. So if you have the combined assets of a dozen employers putting their money into a group of funds, they're going to get better service and they're going to get lower fees than one employer trying to go it alone.
What about self-employed individuals, individuals who are starting up a company, who are still mindful about retirement? Is this potentially an option for them?
It is. There's a special provision in the rules that allows someone who is self-employed to act as both the employer and the employee in the situation, so that they can, as a solo, participate in the group retirement plan.
And this is only in regards to 401k plans, not IRAs, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that's an employer-sponsored plan, and they're only available for these individual account plans, 401ks.
And this is so new that we're still waiting to get further guidance as to exactly what it can look like and what duties and responsibilities are, correct?
Well, we have some final rules, but we don't have a lot of information or real-world experience yet about how these are going to work together. This is one of those areas where you definitely call an employee benefits lawyer to talk you through what the requirements are. There are several that we know about. One is you have to have something in common with the other employers that are sponsoring the plan. You also have to have participation available only to employees of the participating employer. So you can't just have it open for spouses and other family members and so on. So we have some rules of the road, but not a lot of practical experience yet. And so you're going to want to be very careful about how you pursue this. Think carefully about it.
One of the terms that you've used a lot throughout the course of both our conversation and just generally when I've worked with either you or other employee benefits counsel is the term fiduciary duties. Can you explain to our listeners just really briefly, what do you mean when you say, when an attorney says fiduciary duties in this context, what are they talking about?
Sure. So I've talked a lot about the DOL and the IRS, so the Department of Labor and the IRS. The IRS cares all about the numbers, right? What you're putting in, what you're reporting, that sort of stuff. The DOL cares about your fiduciary duties. And your fiduciary duty just means you as an employer, even if you have a business to run, have to recognize that any plan you sponsor, whether it's a retirement plan or a health insurance plan, is a separate legal entity. And when you're doing work on behalf of that plan, when you're making decisions about it, you have to wear a completely separate hat and think about what's best for the plan and the participants in the plan, not necessarily what's most expedient for your business. That can be really hard to do. And that's why when you're making certain decisions, you should talk to outside professionals like investment advisors and attorneys.
Well, that's definitely helpful. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're going to take a quick break and return and talk more with Chris Lockman about the benefits and executive compensation issues small employers most often face.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsandME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsandME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsandME.com. That's JobsandME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Best paints for the job site are at the Home Depot, specifically new Glidden Diamond Paint and Primer. It starts at only $23.98 a gallon. It's specially formulated to spray easier and cover walls faster, a lot faster. So you're done and on to the next job faster. Better paint means better jobs. New Glidden Diamond Paint and Primer starting at just $23.98 a gallon. You'll only find it in one place, the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only.
Life's never perfect, but as realtors, we know living it in the perfect place can make a big difference.
Imagine
hiding from your screeching children in that spacious walk-in closet, watching the neighbor's dog poop on the freshly sodded grass you negotiated during closing, dropping your cell phone in the toilet of the spa-like five-piece bathroom again. So get the perfect place to house all of life's imperfections. Get Realtor. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
We're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Chris Lockman. We've been talking about employee benefits issues faced by smaller employers. Chris, we've spent a significant period of time discussing retirement plans. Let's jump into welfare plans. For people who weren't listening earlier, what is a welfare plan?
Welfare plan is basically any employee benefit plan that's not a retirement plan. So this is your health insurance primarily, and then all of your other benefits, so your short-term disability insurance, those types of benefits you offer your employees.
Considering how broad that potential topic is, it probably makes sense for me not to go through every single type of welfare benefit that there is. But let me just ask some questions generally. So first thing is, what happens if an employer doesn't want to have specific plans, but instead just wants to add to the compensation of their employees and say, here's money for health insurance? Are there problems with doing that?
There can be. Primarily, the issue is if you want to offer your employees money for health insurance on a pre-tax basis. If you just want to pay your employees more because you know they have to go and buy health insurance somewhere, and that's what we're really talking about, it's health insurance, that's okay. The problem is, why would you do that? You've got vehicles that allow you to give them money that they won't be taxed on as income that you as an employer can take a deduction for if you just have a piece of paper in place.
So there are tax benefits not just for the employees, but they're also for my company, as a small business. There's going to be benefits for me as well by setting up, we say, by having a couple pieces of paper.
Exactly. So just like retirement, if you make contributions to your employees' retirement, you can take a deduction for that. The same thing for health insurance. If you're giving your employees money to pay for benefits, you can take a deduction. And there are a couple different ways to do that. The first one that's most common, that we see as a most common issue, is actually it's the cafeteria plan vehicle. So if you want to sponsor a plan for your employees and offer them a choice between taking more cash home or enrolling in a benefit, if you have health insurance that you got through a broker, you have to have what's called a cafeteria plan, also known as a flexible benefit plan or Section 125 plan. If you don't have that in place, and what that plan does, your employees don't ever have to see it. It just sets out the rules for who can enroll and when and how they make a choice about whether they want to get insurance or not. If you don't have one in place, it's a significant problem. You should be taxing your employees on all that money. If you do, you're good to go.
So one of the things I hear so often, and this just isn't in my legal career or from clients, but from friends who start a new job or something like that, doesn't the Affordable Care Act require all employers to offer health insurance benefits to their employees? I mean, wasn't that the purpose of the act is what I hear so often. So why would we even have an issue where an employer is just throwing money at an employee saying, here's money for health insurance?
Well, the answer is no. The Affordable Care Act only requires what they call ALEs, so large employers, which they define as an employer who has 50 full-time or full-time equivalent employees or more. So anyone who's smaller than 50 employees, you don't have to offer health insurance. The reason why people talk a lot about these individual plans and so on, or giving your employees money pre-tax to buy individual insurance on the market, is it's expensive to sponsor an insurance plan. You have to work with a broker, and there's some cost that usually the employer bears in administering it. And so it's kind of a hassle for smaller employers, and they don't often get the best pricing. So one way that is okay, acceptable to offer insurance or offer your employees money to go buy their own insurance is through an HRA. And there are a couple different HRA, health reimbursement account structures.
So if I am a small employer who has 46 employees and I'm going to use the term full-time equivalent employees, right? And I think that in the next couple of years, I'm going to have over 50 full-time employees. Are there steps that I should be taking now to plan in advance for that? Or is that something that once you hit 50, that's when you really start thinking about it?
No, you want to get out ahead of it. And the way to do that actually isn't talk to a lawyer first. It's go talk to an insurance broker. There are lots of benefits consultants and insurance brokers out there. And you can see what the pricing will look like for your particular group of employees. You also want to talk to your employees. What do they want? A lot of employers now are struggling with talent acquisition and retention. We're all kind of fighting for the same pool of really well-qualified employees that we know are going to show up. A way to differentiate yourself if you're a small employer is to offer a health insurance plan, or at least a way to pay on a tax advantage basis for an individual getting their own coverage.
So earlier you talked about something called a cafeteria plan or a Section 125 plan. Is that just, hey, here's four different types, like I can get health insurance for myself, I can get health insurance for me and my child? When we're talking about choices, are we just talking about the type of choice, or does it mean more?
It means a little bit more. So if you want to think about choices from a cafeteria plan, the choice you're talking about is the choice between taking more cash home in my pocket or taking some of my cash that I would otherwise get paid in my paycheck and putting it toward purchasing one of a variety of different benefits, whether that's assistance for childcare, whether that's health insurance or disability insurance.
So with regards to a cafeteria plan, are we only talking about health insurance, or earlier we talked about welfare benefits as being very broad, short-term disability, long-term disability, all kinds of different things? Is a cafeteria plan only based off of health insurance?
Nope. It's based off very broad. So health insurance, but it will also allow you to pay on a pre-tax basis for childcare and all sorts of other different benefits, disability insurance and so on, dental, vision, et cetera.
When we are talking about just benefits generally, right? So we spent a decent amount of time just now talking about health insurance from a welfare standpoint. We threw in short-term disability and long-term disability. So often in offer letters or in separation documents or just generally, I hear people talking about COBRA. Well, don't worry, they'll get COBRA. And I will look at them and say, well, are you sure that COBRA applies to you? And I get a blank stare. First, what's COBRA? And then second, does it apply to every single employer?
The answer is COBRA is just a way of ensuring that people can continue the coverage they had while they were employed after they leave employment. And the answer to your question is no, COBRA does not apply to every employer. Unless you have at least 20 employees, COBRA does not apply to you. And depending on which state you're in, you may have what's called a mini COBRA law in your state, but those are usually very restricted. Here in Maine, we have a mini COBRA law, but it doesn't apply to terminated employees. It's only if you're temporarily laid off and if you have insurance through a particular registered insurer. So you may not have a COBRA option.
So if we were going to talk about a takeaway from today, one of the big things is a recognition or an understanding that people can talk about COBRA, but it is not applicable to every employer or even to every employee.
That's correct. Yeah, there are certain things called qualifying events that give somebody a COBRA right. And remember, that right is their ability to continue the coverage they already have. If you have somebody who's employed by you who doesn't currently have health insurance that you're sponsoring, they don't somehow magically get a right to enroll after you've let them go.
So this is Tawny Alvarez, and you're listening to WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We've been talking to Chris Lockman about employee benefits issues that small employers face. And during the course of that discussion, we've been talking about attracting, retaining. How do we encourage people to stay with us from a retention standpoint when we're talking about benefits? After this break, I'd like to wrap up by talking a little bit more about executive compensation issues. We'll be back in just a moment.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Today's economic environment presents many challenges. It seems as though it's harder than ever to navigate the investment landscape to seek out adequate return and manage risk at the same time. ClearPoint Financial is a financial advocate for those who need assistance making complex decisions about how to manage their wealth. They inspire their clients to make informed decisions through education, communication, and service that exceeds expectation. Call Michael Toole at ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes. They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then,
hey!
The dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
We're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today's guest is attorney Chris Lockman, and we've been talking about employee benefit issues faced by smaller employees. We just finished talking about welfare benefits, and earlier we talked about retirement benefits. And I tell you what, my head is absolutely swimming with all of the information that you have provided with us today, Chris. So I feel like, one, how is there even time to talk about executive compensation first? And then second, why does any of this matter? Wouldn't it be easier for me and for so many other employers to just say, this is too big of a headache to deal with?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, we hear that sometimes. It can be frustrating. But why we offer benefits to our employees, nobody makes you unless you're larger than 50 full-time employees or full-time equivalents. Nobody makes you provide benefits to your employees, including retirement benefits. You don't have to have a retirement plan. You have it so that you can attract new talent and so that you can retain talent and so that you have a way to retire at some point, even if you're a partial owner of the business or running the company.
When we talk about executive compensation agreements, earlier you mentioned that's advising more on C-suite type issues. I mean, what do you mean advising on C-suite issues? Isn't it just a here's your contract, have at it? What kind of added things would there be or necessity to talk to a lawyer about some of that stuff?
Well, so many people who are in the upper level management type realm will have employment agreements and contracts, and oftentimes, probably without them even thinking about it, will stumble into some executive compensation issues because above and beyond what they want to get paid and for their salary, they may have a long-term incentive plan, like a bonus plan. Well, that's an executive compensation issue. If you stay around for so many years, we're going to pay you a certain amount of money, assuming you meet these performance benchmarks. That's an executive compensation issue, and that's an executive compensation arrangement.
And that's something that it would be recommended that you check to make sure that whatever plan that you've set up meet certain, I'm guessing, IRS standards to make sure that you're everyone, both the employer and the employer, appropriately paying taxes on that?
Sure. And I won't get into the weeds of you know, the details, but the IRS puts limits on how much compensation you can defer into the future. They want to tax you, and they want to tax you every year. 409A of the code is huge, and it affects many of these agreements because it limits just how much they're going to allow you to put aside tax-free.
Now, when we're talking about incentivizing or attracting employees, have you found that recently there's some things that have become standard that maybe weren't standard in the past, which is making it more difficult for smaller employees to, in fact, attract individuals to join or be part of their workforce?
Yeah, I think part of it is with how tight the labor market is, employers are really having to compete with one another for talent, and that can be tough because there are a lot of new entrepreneurs who are in the marketplace who have a great idea, and they may have designs on huge future income, but they don't have a lot of cash right now to get off the ground. Executive compensation arrangements can help them because there are several different types, but one way that you can design an agreement is to allow somebody stock in the company, a promise of stock that they won't have to pay tax on currently, that they will get paid out so long as they meet certain benchmarks or stay for a certain period of time. That will help a small company lure away someone from a much larger company who can pay a much larger salary and say, listen, you're doing fine right now. We can do one better if you stay with us for a given period of time.
Well, I feel like my head is swimming even more now. Thank you so much, Chris, for being a guest today. I really appreciate it. I know I have learned a lot. I hope that our listeners who operate or own small businesses have also gotten a worthwhile fill of information.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, WLOBradio.com. Tune in next week.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
This is Liz Johnston at Verrill Dana. Do you pay your employees for attending training programs? You probably know that employees must be paid for all hours spent working, but it's important to know whether your employee training falls in the definition of hours worked under the Fair Labor Standards Act to avoid a potential wage and hour issue later on. The FLSA provides that training programs and other similar activities do not need to be counted as hours worked if four criteria are met. Attendance must be outside the employee's regular working hours, attendance must be voluntary, the employee must not perform any productive work during attendance, and the course, lecture, or meeting or training must not be directly related to the employee's job. But when is training directly related to the employee's job? The FLSA indicates that this turns on whether the training is designed to make the employee more effective at his current position, which would weigh on being directly related, or whether the training offers an additional, higher skills designed toward advancement. If you have questions about whether your training programs should be counted as hours worked, contact me or another member of Verrill Dana's Labor and Employment Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.